everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Scary movie love for scary movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley. Happy Scary Movie Month, everyone. I'm very excited for this very special episode because here to talk the original, the OG, Carrie, is the biggest telekinetic I know, JB.
And I really appreciate you inviting me here, Cassie, and I'm sure we're going to do a great job.
I applaud you for not opening with, they're all going to laugh at you.
No, and why don't we get this out of the way right now? Recently, I attended Monsterpalooza in Burbank, which is just, I'm so high on Monsterpalooza now for various reasons. Read my column.
And drugs.
But I was also told that the big one in the spring in Pasadena is so big that it's getting to be like Comic-Con in San Diego, and that it's a bit, not awe-inspiring, but it's, you know, it's very, very crowded. So I love Burbank. And one of the celebrities at Monsterpalooza Burbank a few weeks ago was Piper Laurie. And as you know, I am not shy about approaching celebrities and saying things. And for some reason, I couldn't, because I have so much respect for her, I couldn't figure out what to say. And I felt bad that, although she's a person with her own volition, she was sentencing herself to 3 days and nights of signing 8x10s. My guess is they're all going to laugh at you is the most popular thing that people want.
Maybe you could have had her sign, I can see your dirty pillows.
Well, I was thinking that I'm trying to think of the exact quote. She probably gets far less requests for the first sin was intercourse.
Right.
But, and we'll get to this in a second, Piper Laurie's performance is so tremendously great. And on the recent Shout Factory Blu-ray, where they not only included old extras, but they made new extras, one of which is like this weird time warp. Did you notice this? There's two about acting.
Right.
And one of them is from the MGM disc.
Right.
And everyone's still pretty young.
Right.
And then they felt the need to get these people back together. It's very strange.
That happens often.
But I didn't realize that after The Hustler, Piper Laurie took a big break from acting.
Yeah.
And that Carrie was sort of her comeback. It's so great that it makes you uncomfortable and not in this comforting, we're in the hands of a master way.
Sure.
It's really uncomfortable in a we're in the hands of a maniac way, to paraphrase John Landis.
One of the reasons we are talking about Carrie is because if you are listening to this the day it comes out, October 10th,
bright and early,
Mike Pomero's birthday. Happy birthday, Mike. Please, everyone, send him gifts from Friday the 13th, Part 7, his favorite horror movie. tonight in the Chicagoland area at the Elk Grove Cinema, I will be hosting a screening of Carrie and then talking about the movie a little bit afterwards. I've never seen it on a big screen, so I'm very excited about that.
And I can't wait, because for a long time, the age of this got in my way. That the early video versions didn't look good. It had that 70s schmutzy look.
Yeah.
But most especially, starting with the 80s, the fashions and the hairstyles really dated it. I think that's less true now.
I agree.
But I realized, as I rewatched it for this podcast, that that was just a gloss. That I was just telling myself, I don't want to go back to that 70s relic. I live that. William Katt's hair is hilarious. But why I was really avoiding it is that the film cuts really close and speaks in a very clear way about some really uncomfortable subjects, like being bullying, like being bullied.
Right.
Ooh, Freudian slip. And that's why I didn't want to go back,
okay.
I think. It's interesting. I think in the 80s or the 90s, that really prevented a lot of people from enjoying it, because a lot of the online reviews I read kept insisting that it was dated.
Yeah. I think that has to do with the clothes and the hairstyles.
Yeah.
And I would argue that the only thing that really is dated, I mean, I recognize some of those things are, but the only sequence where I'm like, huh, is that sped up trying on the prom tuxedo sequence, which I'm like,
yes,
that's not a choice you would make now.
Yesterday, I didn't quite remember that scene.
Yeah.
And it's so short and weird.
Yeah.
I thought my Blu-ray was malfunctioning.
Every time I watch it, I'm like, this is the one misstep, but who cares?
I meant to ask you before we started recording, but clearly I was watching the director approved version.
We are getting ahead of ourselves, of course, because...
Because this film is so great!
It's Scary Movie Month, which means the Scary Movie Challenge. Every time you watch a horror movie in October, go to fthismovie.com, click on that day's post for the Scary Movie Challenge, write a 7-word review. The ones we're going to read some of the ones we like on the podcast. I started to say the ones we like we read, but that suggests that I'm not reading ones because I don't like them. I like so many of them. I just can't read them all.
The ones we hate, we try to forget.
Trite.
We try to put them out of our mind.
I said true and right, and it came out trite.
I spent a delightful hour going back over, I think, the last 5 days.
Yeah.
And I have to say, the learning curve is swift that... Every year, I think they get better.
Yeah.
Although, suspiciously, I read a couple that sounded real familiar. So, have we been doing this long enough where people are repeating jokes and maybe even they don't remember it?
I think that's definitely possible. I'm sure I've done that.
Are people posting old chestnuts deliberately? Naughty, 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 listeners.
I do not think that that is the case.
This went over well in 2014.
I think they're repeating jokes that either they made and they don't realize it, or even two people come up with the same joke. Yeah, I don't think anybody's plagiarizing past reviews because it would be tedious to go through them.
I have to admit, the other night I desperately wanted to post something because now in my retirement, I've been trying to keep up and watch at least one movie a day, and I watched The Invisible Man for some reason, and I had nothing.
Yeah.
I just had nothing.
It's hard sometimes.
So what I posted is just, what's that word? It's so hacky. It's just the hackiest thing. I try to avoid hacky. I'm not even going to say it out loud on the podcast. I'm going to let some of you find it and then groan.
All right, let's read some of these. J Bones, go first.
Okay, friend of the site, J.M. Vargas, reviewed George Romero's Season of the Witch from 1972 and wrote, "Feminist fantasy falters fast, ferociously foul fashions."
I have a J.M. Vargas as well, of John Carpenter's The Ward. Better title, John Carpenter's The Rent Money.
One. Lindsay Wilkins reviews House of Frankenstein from 1944, and her 7-word review is Wolfman's awkward Tinder profile, kill me.
Lauren Cristiano of House on Haunted Hill, 1999, like most things, needs more Vincent Price.
You bet. Yeah. He is bacon.
Yeah.
Big friend of the site, Eric Aschberschlager, reviews The Shape of Water from last year, and his review is Steven Tyler voice, love with an alligator.
Frank Levesque of The Green Inferno. Meat was overcooked. Would not go again.
And I have one from Mr. Levesque as well. His review of the original Night of the Living Dead from 1968 is, I never liked hanging with Mr. Cooper.
John Kervan of Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, discussed on last week's podcast. CD head Cenobite obviously values physical media.
That's one for our friend Heath. Blaine Higby reviews the film Return of the Living Dead by saying, Resurrection Cemetery must be near Foreshadowing Lane.
Hold on, wait for it. This one made me laugh so hard, and I can't totally explain why or even. Scott Jack of Dracula 1931. Nick Fury shows up after the credits.
I have that one as well, and that is one of my favorite ones. In fact, hold on, I put a little star next to it. No, that's not the starred one, although someone responded to Scott Jack's thing with a little note that said it was really great.
Yeah.
I know we're not supposed to quote ourselves, but Adam Risky reviewed Tales from the Dark Side, which I actually watched with Adam 2 days ago. I was lucky enough to do that. And his review is, I'd marry a gargoyle if she converted.
I will quote somebody else from the site, Lexi Van Dyke of Hocus Pocus, helping parents explain virginity since 1993.
Charles Lewis reviews Mad Monster Party from 1967 and summarizes every single one of our opinions on this film. His seven-word review, more monsters, more songs, almost entirely boring.
Every time it seems like a great idea.
Oh, you put it in the opening for the first 10 minutes.
I love this.
And then you get there's a musical number with the chef.
Anyway,
which I later learned they did later and added it to pad it out to feature length.
It does not need padding.
Oh no.
70 minutes would have been fine. That's a feature. Well, it doesn't need to be 90 or more, which is what it is.
You expect the mountain to sing a song. I am hosting all these monsters. A big ballad. A big anthemic ballad.
It's like Bob Odenkirk as the milk machine from that Mr. Show sketch. Anyway, Thor Jensen of The Haunted House, 1921. That ghost effect kind of looks like sheet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. It's good.
Brett Cullum reviews Halloween 2 from 1981 and writes, Michael Myers haunts world's most empty hospital.
Yeah. Daniel Epler of Bad Moon. Why wouldn't a dog like a werewolf?
Ryan Heintz reviews Aliens from 1986 and writes, when will mom-on-mom violence end?
Lacey R. of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978. Who's there? Silence. Good enough for me.
I wrote that one down, too. That one's great. Ben Peterson reviews Dracula, Prince of Darkness from 1966, and his review is, don't hide secret torture chamber with rug.
Jeremy Wickett of Frankenstein, 1931, the subject of this week's Thrills, Chills, and Spills. Go to fthismovie.com to read it. Thrills, Chills, and Kills, I should say. Says, Angry Mob sounds good right now, right?
And I have to, just to take a pause, this proves every commentator on every documentary's point that fake horrors help us deal with real horrors. Reading all of these reviews over the last couple days, some events that are contemporary seem to be creeping into people's comments. Clint Pop reviews John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982 and writes, identity theft is a scary thing.
Kanji Chris of Reanimator. West loves resurrection is dick to pencils.
I almost wrote that one down. Yep. It's on one of the Halloween CDs. I'm beginning to think in my top 10 of favorite dialogue from a horror film is a line from Reanimator, and it's also in the trailer, which is why I listen to it over and over on the CD. Is he dead? Not anymore. It's the greatest line. And this is the one that I'm not the only one who liked. A friend of the site, Miko, commented that this was his favorite one, too. Said perhaps it would be his favorite one of the entire season. Casey Doran reviews Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 1974, and the review is, yokels make outsider art, turn outsiders inside out.
Pretty brilliant. We should pause real quick to thank Miko, who has been tallying every day's count and then posting it to Twitter. So thank you so much, Miko.
And it's a thankless task, so I won't be thanking you. But
I am thanking you, Miko.
Some people.
It's amazing what you're doing.
Might appreciate
let's
it.
Go with the sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Patrick McAllister of Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. Riveting live radio broadcast from Chili Contest.
I almost wrote that one down, too. Lacey R. reviews the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. And the seven-word review reads,
Who's there? Silence. I literally just read this one. I just read it.
Out loud?
Yes! Like three people ago.
You're kidding.
No.
See, I'm paying attention to my list.
Obviously. Got another one?
I'm sorry. Chase Spence. I'm such a dolt. Chase Spence reviews the recent remake of It. And the review reads, headline, boat missing, last seen with arm.
Nice. Tom S. Tex of Tales of Halloween. Adrian, Barbara, Caroline, my ABCs of death.
Very nice.
Yes.
This one gave me pause, and the more I thought about it, the funnier and the more awful it became. So think about this for a couple seconds, because this is, I think this is one of the most twisted ones I've ever read. Once again, our friend Frank Levesque reviews the film Mother, lowercase m, from 2017, and his review simply reads, "Must be this tall to crowd surf."
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That is a new level of depravity.
I'm out, so you keep going.
And I have one left.
Okay.
Jonathan Mills from the recent delightful House with a Clock in Its Walls from this year. His seven-word review reads, "Baby Jack Black is haunting my dreams."
Yes.
That's the minute that thing showed up, I was sitting there saying, "Oh, I'll be seeing that later tonight."
That's a disturbing image. J-Bones, have you seen anything scary lately?
Have I seen anything scary lately? Did we discuss The House with the Clock in Its Walls, which I thought was delightful?
No, we did not.
And you saw it.
I did.
I think I liked it a lot more than you did.
Perhaps.
I recognize that there are two sequences that don't need to be in the film, but in the words of my wife, they are there in case they decide to do a House with a Clock in Its Walls video game. The fight with the pumpkins is great fodder for the trailer. I remember that, in fact, from the trailer. But given where it is in the narrative, we're just starting the third act, for the film to pause for that long. Again, it's a quibble. It's delightful. I loved every frame. And, of course, I kept going back, not to see The House with a Clock in Its Walls, but I actually managed to see Thriller in 3D three times that week.
Wow.
And once it was free, because none of the automation at the AMC theaters works. Nothing actually works the way they want it to work. So the whole stub system was down, so they just gave me a free pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost felt like coming clean and saying, "This will cost you nothing because I'm leaving after Thriller." Could we just work this out so that every day this week we could go through this little charade? But I didn't. I think in a lot of different reviews we're mentioning this, in the way that Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein sort of becomes the first horror film that some kids watch. Hopefully it's Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, not Mad Monster Party. Monsters are boring. That in the future, maybe House with a Clock in Its Walls will be sort of people's first putting their toe into horror. But I loved it. I just thought it was great. And it's so wonderful when you get performances like Jack Black and Cate Blanchett. I mean, it's really funny. They're sniping at each other.
Yeah.
It's them that makes that funny, not necessarily the lines,
sure,
but the way that they're saying them, the performances feel sort of lived in. And I know it's not a horror film, and I won't spend more than a minute on this, but you saw A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
And did you like it?
Yeah.
I really liked it for one main reason. The dramatic scenes had some air in them.
Mm-hmm.
At times they seem like improvisations, that the film was in no hurry, and that they sort of came across as much more realistic as other dramas that are sort of hurtling to get to the second act or something.
Sure.
I really appreciated the fact that the film took its time. And at the end, when the Bradley Cooper character becomes that three-headed alcoholic monster and starts beheading his band.
And you understand why they put it out in October.
This is so clever that nothing in the trailer spoiled this.
It worked out. I was like, oh, this counts for Scary Movie Month now.
Wait till you read my seven-word review.
And you watched a couple things at Adam's house.
Yes, Adam had a little get-together. And I have to say, it's so delightful when people who host these, and at this point I'm looking at the master, because Patrick has been hosting Scary Movie Night every year since he was in the womb. I don't quite know how he did it, but he managed to sort of, well, imagine it, like puppeteer his mom from the inside to invite us.
That's a horror movie right
there. I think I was 20. Patrick shows little short things between the movies, and I think sometimes that's more fun than the feature. I don't know what it would be like to sit through like 8 hours of those.
Right, sometimes
you need a narrative.
Yeah.
But Adam's house was great, and he showed great things between the movies. And Adam showed Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, which I will never not love.
Yeah.
It's so, so great. Although, sitting there, in Adam's apartment, and I mentioned this in my 7-word review. Imagine if they had done Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, like a repertory company of actors, and the same 5 actors had done all 3 stories.
Okay.
That would be interesting.
Sure.
And then he showed Wishmaster, because Adam.
Because it's Adam, right?
And I don't think I had ever seen Wishmaster before.
That would not surprise me.
It was interesting because Kurtzman directed it, and parts of it, I think, come across like an effects reel of
the opening and the closing
announcing KNB.
Oh, for
here's
sure.
What we're capable of,
for sure.
But not just the beginning and the end. In the middle, someone gets set on fire.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Oh, we here's something we're also able to offer.
Yeah.
And he also showed Night Flyer.
Yeah,
which I had never seen before. And I really like Night Flyer because every minute it's Stephen King doing his take on Dracula, and it's real interesting. I think the second act is really slow, that maybe it could be shorter.
I haven't seen it for years.
And then he showed May, which I first saw at a Music Box Massacre.
That's right.
With you. And boy, did it play at the Music Box Massacre. It played so well at the Music Box Massacre, I remembered it being shorter than it actually is. And I think maybe when I first saw it at the Music Box Massacre, there were a whole bunch of actors in it who I didn't know yet.
Sure.
Because that was a while ago.
Sure, yeah.
So watching it a few days ago, it was like, oh, Jeremy Sisto and
Anna Faris
and the young man who's in Independence Day.
Yes.
He's
James,
got that crazy,
James Duvall.
Yeah, James Duvall's got that crazy hair.
Yeah.
And it was delightful. There was treats. My wife made Rice Krispie treats with Count Chocula, which I urge. You might think, well, marshmallows, but Count Chocula has marshmallows.
Right.
No. As my wife has reminded me plenty of times, those marshmallows in Count Chocula, Blueberry, and Frankenberry, those ain't marshmallows.
Right. No, they're not.
They're really good.
Okay.
Rice Krispie treats with Count Chocula.
All right.
Perhaps she will bring them to Scary Movie Night.
Let us hope so.
It was delightful.
Good. I don't even know what I should talk about. I've mostly been...
You've been busy with the horror films.
Yeah, but I've been re-watching a lot of stuff because I've learned from past mistakes.
I noticed that when you posted that you had watched Tucker and Dale again.
Yeah. I hadn't seen it, I don't think, since we were at that screening of it.
Still fun, right?
Yeah. I don't have quite the same affection for it as everybody else, but there are moments that I think are really funny, and the premise is pretty funny.
I am officially an Alan Tudyk fan.
Yeah. In years past, I've tried to watch a lot of new stuff, and that can lead to a bad month because a lot of it's going to suck, you know?
That was sort of your modus operandi for many years.
Yeah.
That whole thing where people save things for October.
Sure. And maybe it's just at the point now. It's not that I've seen everything, but I did absorb so many new movies over the last 7 or 8 years that there are fewer new movies for me to watch. I still need to watch The Changeling. I saved that for this month. So I've been re-watching a lot of stuff. One movie that I did watch that was new to me that I had never seen but I've heard great things about is The Blood on Satan's Claw, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
I really, really liked it. I mean, it reminded me a lot of Witchfinder General, which is not a particularly insightful observation because it takes place during the same time and it's sort of about the same thing. But Blood on Satan's Claw is willing to go a little bit further with what it suggests.
I haven't seen either of them in a really long time, but I remembered when you posted the Scary Movie primer for this year. I went back and I reread some things, and I listened again to the podcast we did, you, Doug, me, and my lovely wife, directly after the one massacre that was at the Portage.
Yeah.
And everyone in the room was really high on Witchfinder General.
Yeah.
Except me.
That movie's great. You're nuts. No, I'm just kidding.
There's a delightful theme running through that podcast where we have coerced our friend Doug into staying up for 24 hours, and a lot of his contributions to the podcast could be summarized with the three of us are animatedly talking about horror films, and occasionally Doug should just come in. Why? Why? Why on earth would you?
I rewatched Starry Eyes, which you still haven't seen, right?
I have not seen it.
It's pretty incredible. Anyway, and the only other rewatch that I'll mention is The Editor, which came out a couple years ago from the Astron 6 guys, and I think was another Scream Factory pickup. They distributed it. And it's a movie that I really liked when I saw it, and I like it more each time I see it because I recognize that it's probably too long for the joke to sustain itself. It's every Italian horror movie ever made. It's a parody of Italian horror.
That makes me want to see it.
But also, you know, an Italian horror movie.
You have this on a little shiny disc?
I do.
Ooh.
And every time I see it, I've seen more movies in between.
So
I get more of the references, you know.
It's the famous Jack Nicholson quote, man. Experience expands enjoyment.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it even more this time because there are shots that are combining two different movies in a 4-second shot. And you're like, holy shit, how did they pull that off? It's pretty amazing.
So the filmmakers did their homework.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fun.
When the podcast is over, I actually have two suggestions for Scary Movie Night.
Okay.
Because I know how much you enjoy people suggesting things for Scary Movie
Night. I have no problem with people suggesting things.
Really?
Yeah. I really don't. Just because I may not take the suggestion doesn't mean that
I'm joking.
Refuse to have something suggested. Let's talk about Carrie.
I watched it again yesterday.
Yeah.
And man, that Shout Factory, Scream Factory disc. They're not kidding, 4K. And again, I'm a victim of having seen most of these films in my wasted youth on really crappy VHS copies where the transfer was just,
get it out.
So all of these restorations or near restorations are a marvel. And man, does it look good.
Yes.
Also, on many of the extras on the Scream Factory disc, the interview with the editor, the interview with the composer. Scream Factory takes particular delight in using a clip from the opening credits that show the man's name. But it seems to be an excuse to just show all that nudity again. Because the opening credits are in the locker room.
There's a story, I don't know if this is true or not, that the editor maybe... that his credit appears over Nancy Allen's nude shot. And when his friends saw the movie, they were incensed that his name had been left out of the opening credits because they didn't notice it. I don't know if that's true or not.
Here's a question. The composer of the score.
Yes.
And the score is really, really good.
Yeah, I love it.
How do you pronounce his name?
Pino Donaggio?
It's Donaggio.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I should know this. I'm Italian, but... one of the better extras on the Scream Factory disc is the interview with him because he talks about how most people would score a horror film and how he chooses to do it in a different way. And I thought that was fascinating. Long story short, he wants to establish this mood that sort of lulls you away from the horror. He describes it as like a lullaby or an incantation, like a spell. And then you break the spell with the horror aspects, which are much more, you know, sort of common, like string stings and stuff
like that.
Right. But I thought that was really insightful. I'm surprised that the film, I think most people would recognize, oh, it's this really, really great horror film. But considering how great it is in so many ways, I'm surprised that it doesn't actually get talked about more. And is that part of that, oh, well, that's this thing from the 70s that's dated?
Maybe, but think about how much The Exorcist gets talked about, or even Rosemary's Baby from the 60s.
No, that's an excellent point, because if anything, I'm watching Carrie now, many years after I first saw it. And when I first saw it, I was in high school. And now I'm watching it after having taught in a high school for over 30 years. And not a whole hell of a lot about high school has changed.
No.
The portrait of high school and how awful it is in every single way. Every single thing. In fact, I'm watching it yesterday. I'm like, oh, man, I did that for decades, man. How did I stand to do that? There must have been some good part. Maybe the edumacation part. But high school's the worst. And Stephen King knows this. He was teaching at the time he wrote it.
Right.
And Brian De Palma certainly understands this. It seems like most people who made the film understand this. Nancy Allen says something interesting in one of the interviews that when she was filming her scenes with John Travolta, she had no idea how they would come across in the larger fabric of the film.
Right.
And when they were making them, she and Travolta thought that they were the comic relief.
Right.
But when those things are cut into the rest of the film, maybe we're laughing at some of Travolta's little mannerisms, like don't call me that and stuff. I was actually really surprised when he hits her.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hitting in this film.
Yeah.
And none of it comes across as particularly comic, especially when
Betty
Carrie's
Buckley.
Mom hits her.
Sure.
It's disturbing.
Yeah.
When Betty Buckley hits Nancy Allen, it's disturbing.
That's very jarring, yeah.
So it's this... De Palma is so much of an artist, even at that point in his career, that he's not going to give us the easy version.
Right. And yet, I think so much of the movie plays, at least cinematically, like this high school fantasy, which again speaks to the Pino Donaggio score. It's a movie that I don't think is a horror movie until it is.
I can see, although you could argue that the first hour is build up.
Yeah,
for what's inevitably to come. I was struck yesterday by how comfortable De Palma is with some ambiguity. And I keep coming back to Betty Buckley's gym teacher character because her first reaction to the Carrie incident in the shower is she hits Carrie because he's hysterical. And then later she hits Chris because she's a pain in the neck. And that there's that one scene where she's talking to Carrie in the mirror and convincing Carrie to go to the prom and if you do your hair and makeup and stuff. And De Palma has a, I think it's a zoom shot. It might be a tracking shot. You know the shot that I'm talking about. It starts with the two women in the mirror and it ends on Betty Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what's actually going on in the scene, am I the only one who thinks that's odd? Because another filmmaker would...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the question is, why does that shot end on Betty Buckley?
I don't know the answer.
I would like to suggest an answer.
Yeah, I figured.
That the Betty Buckley character isn't quite the... Obviously, she's not the hero. She's not as sympathetic as she might seem. Because clearly, she eventually does the right thing by Carrie
and
tries to look out for her and tries to punish the girls in a way that'll have some effect. But there's something about the way it's written and the way Betty Buckley performs it where she's not 100% good. She really seems to get gleeful pleasure out of punishing the girls. Can we get into spoilers?
Yeah, it's... This movie came out in 1976 and has been remade three times since.
The thing that first struck me when I saw the movie originally, and the thing that struck me yesterday was, what really distinguishes this film is when the Betty Buckley character gets it during the prom.
Yeah.
And if memory serves, that character does not suffer the same fate in the book.
Or in any of the movies, I don't think.
So... It's not in the book. What is it in the screenwriter's mind and De Palma's mind that say she gets punished too?
I don't know that I ever saw it as punishment necessarily. And that was the horror of
it. Right.
Even the good people die. And I recognize she's not entirely good.
Because on one side of the coin, I'm thinking, well, all of that other stuff where I'm having ambiguous reactions to the Betty Buckley character, clearly at that point in the film announces that she's going to get it too. But the other half was what you were saying, that's what made it such a great horror film, because once this thing is unleashed, the horror of it is that you can't control it.
Right.
And you can't make two
lists.
You're
not just going to punish. Right, exactly.
And I guess in the book, there's a scene where Carrie looks through the windows of the gym and explicitly makes the decision to start the fire and lock the door.
Yes. And then walks through the town and does the same thing to other places in town. She kind of burns the entire town to the ground.
And it's almost as if the screenwriter and De Palma are looking at those scenes in the book and sort of extrapolating from them that once the id is released, if you will, once his genie is out of the bottle, it's not like you can pick and choose.
Right.
Nancy Allen is so horrible as a person. I mean, the performance is really, really good, because we've all known people like that. The car flips and flips and flips and flips, and then it explodes in a fireball. And I'm sitting there saying, I don't think she got enough punishment.
I mean, it is interesting that they escape the gym. They're not inside, right? And you're like, oh, Jesus, the teacher's going to get it, and they're not. We talked about the sped up prom sequence.
Yes.
The way that the car flip is executed by just spinning the film itself. Yeah. That's one thing I wish was different.
Well, you take the shot that you love from Let Me In.
Right home, Jesus.
And where we now have the technical capability to do that.
I think even not showing the inside of the car would have helped.
Oh, no, would.
It's a distraction at a big moment.
Through our modern eyes, I think that would strengthen the sequence. But the other thing I thought watching it yesterday was, I didn't want to turn into the quibbler, but I was wondering about the chronology of it, and I'm guessing this is De Palma's skill as a filmmaker. I kept wondering until the last moment if Tommy and Sue were in on it. I really did.
Okay. Even on this watch?
Yes.
Okay.
Clearly, it's made clear that they're not.
Right.
But why would the Chris character go to all the trouble of rigging the blood and rigging the election if she didn't know Carrie would be there? Or did that plan come into being once Chris learned that Sue was going to convince Tommy to ask Carrie to the prom? Is that what I missed?
I believe so, yes.
Because clearly once Sue gets to the prom, you know that she had nothing to do with it.
Right.
And I'm guessing is why she's spared
in the morality
of the film.
Yes.
Although, again, because it's De Palma, we learned, well, there's being spared and there's being spared.
And Tommy's not spared.
Right. Although the film is much less definitive about Tommy's fate than the book is. Tommy gets hit with the bucket, lands on the stage, and then in the bonus features, William Catt says, and then I basically had it laid there for a couple days while they shot all the rest of the stuff. Do we get an explicit shot, like the shot of PJ Souls, that shows him being taken out other than the bucket hitting his head and him hitting the floor?
And then the entire building being set on fire.
Okay. But we have to extrapolate.
So if the bucket doesn't kill him, the fire does.
Sure.
Yes.
And I remember in the book, that's more explicit.
Sure.
That we are told because it's a book.
Right.
That.
Right. The last two times I've watched this, and it was a couple of years ago, this was the movie that I watched on Halloween night. I don't know why. I just picked this one. And I was like, holy shit, this is one of my favorite horror movies. The last two times I've watched it, both on the Screen Factory Blu-ray. William Katt's performance stands out to me as just being so great, so believable. He's just such a an actual person.
Yes.
In the way that he reacts to everything around him. He's not taking anything very seriously, but he's not a bad guy. He's popular, but it hasn't gone to his head.
Right. And I would suggest, because we have built up expectations of the big man on campus.
Right.
How we feel about him, that first scene in the English classroom when that horrible teacher is reading his poem, and we certainly see why Sidney Lassett gets it. As the film goes on, everything William Katt does humanizes that character and makes him more of a real person.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, I love, and I love the scene of him at the table with Carrie where he convinces her to vote for themselves, and her reaction to that after she does it, where she kind of covers her face, is just the best.
And I also like, because a lot of films that revolve around high school have a lot of stereotypes, and it's sort of portrayed with very broad brushstrokes, that Sue is honestly trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that she's the one girl who honestly feels bad about what happens and is trying to make amends.
Yeah. Have you seen The Rage, Carrie 2?
No, I have not.
It's like, as a 90s horror movie, it's okay. As a loose remake of Carrie, it's not bad. The big objection I have to it is, spoilers for The Rage, Carrie 2, they bring Sue Snell back. She's like a guidance counselor.
Yeah, I read about this on the Wikipedia.
She's standing outside of the school or the pool. I think it's a pool in The Rage, Carrie 2, where the shit goes down. She's standing outside, but gets like something launches through a window and impales her through the head. And that's how she's killed. And it's like they're trying to do the same thing with that they did with Betty Buckley in the original. But you can't do that to Sue Snell.
Right.
You can't.
Watching Carrie yesterday reminded me of just how little I remember from the remake with Chloe Grace Moretz.
So I was clicking around on YouTube, actually trying to find clips of Carrie the musical, which we should probably talk about, which there's a lot of David Scull's book, The Monster Show, is devoted to Carrie the musical, which was where I first learned about it.
And Betty Buckley says some interesting things about it, because there is a bonus feature on the musical. I would love to see clips, because when it was revived, it was very substantially rewritten and a lot of songs were dropped and stuff. But Betty Buckley tells the story that on opening night, when the curtain closed, people were booing.
Right.
There was a lot of booing. And she didn't know how to react to that, because that had never happened before.
Right.
And the poor girl who played Carrie had never been in a show before. So this poor little girl was like turning to Betty Buckley. What do we do?
Yeah.
And the curtain opened and they stepped forward and the booing turned to cheers because the audience enjoyed their performances. They just thought the show was awful.
Right.
And Buckley just is amazed that she had never seen anything like that in the theater. And her experience in the theater is pretty extensive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She was in the original cast of Cats.
Right. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, in the mid-80s, was it?
Yeah.
That they tried to turn Carrie into a musical. It was very expensive. It ran for something like 15 previews.
It had a very elaborate set.
And 5 performances. And then they shut it down because it was such a disaster. Betty Buckley played
Margaret White.
Yeah, Mrs. White. There is something on YouTube that has some clips from each of the songs featuring the original actor. So it was like, it's like a highlight reel from a rehearsal or something. So you do get to see Betty Buckley singing as Mrs. White. You do get to see the girl who played Carrie.
And what's it like?
I mean, it's hard to... You just feel bad. It's like these are talented people singing awful material.
But it's like those producers were ahead of the curve, because nowadays it seems like there's no Broadway musical that isn't pre-sold
because it's
based on something people have affection
for. And I think now when it's when people do it, they're doing it ironically. Not movies. I mean Carrie the musical. I think there's an episode of Riverdale where they do Carrie the musical. Anyway, I'm clicking around on YouTube and I got to the a scene from the remake, and it's the prom scene, and it's the pig's blood coming down on Chloe Moretz, and then what's his name? Ansel Elgort.
Yes. Because when I saw Carrie the remake, yeah, I did not yet know who Ansel Elgort was.
I didn't either, and I remember liking his performance. Maybe that was the only thing that I liked. But he kind of goes, what the hell? And then he gets the bucket on him, and I thought, well, that's so perfect for a remake that we have to articulate the thing that's only suggested. Listen, I don't want to make it about appearances, but when you're watching Chloe Grace Moretz on the stage getting the pig's blood dumped on her, you're wondering what they were thinking casting her.
Well, and even when Brian De Palma's Carrie came out, there were some King purists who thought that Sissy Spacek.
And she is. She's beautiful.
Right.
They, you know, kind of make her look mousy for most of the movie, and then the prom is sort of her coming out. But yeah, in the Stephen King book, she's overweight. She has acne and glasses. She is described as more physically unappealing than anyone who's ever played her in a movie.
But we should talk briefly about Sissy Spacek's performance, because it's amazing.
Yeah.
And if we take as our definition of drama the fact that we're going to follow human beings as they change, Sissy Spacek does an amazing job with the gradual change of Carrie. Mm-hmm. Considering what she is at the beginning, she's lightly resisting her mother. But in that first scene between her and Piper Laurie, I noticed that as much as she says, no, Mama, she winds up saying everything the mother wants her to say.
Yeah.
She eventually gets browbeaten into saying it. And then, and this is what I love as a former teacher, she starts to look up what's going on in books in the library. And she discovers what telekinesis is and that there are people who have this ability. And she is empowered by this knowledge.
Yeah.
And she becomes a foe to her mother. And I don't want to get into this too thick, but one of the things I love about the film is I'm not the biggest fan of crazy organized religion. And clearly this film comes out against the sort of blind following of dogma that leads to you thinking you're doing the right thing, but you're abusing your child.
Right.
You're abusing your only child.
Yeah.
And the more information she gets and the more powerful she becomes a really great foil to her mom. I'm still surprised. And just recently, I noticed that someone made this mistake, that a lot of people think the little icon in her prayer closet and the final image of mom crucified in the kitchen, that both of those are referenced to Jesus Christ, but they're not. That's that famous painting of Saint Sebastian.
There's so many things that
with the arrows going into it.
Oh, okay.
That's what's
right.
I mean, clearly someone has made a little... Ooh, it's so creepy. And De Palma has the eyes light up, which is unnerving. But clearly that's what De Palma is recreating in the kitchen scene. It's a famous painting of Saint Sebastian with all these arrows in it.
There's so many things that I mean to bring up, but let's talk about the crucifixion of the mom. Because in the book it's different. Carrie stops her mom's heart.
Yes.
In other film adaptations, Carrie stops her mom's heart. Again, De Palma is smart enough to realize that's not cinematic, and he is nothing if not a cinematic director.
You got it.
I mean, honestly, few filmmakers I can think of understand visual storytelling better.
And not only is that sequence amazing, but this is one of the greatest things I took from all the bonus features on this Scream Factory disc that you must own. Piper Laurie's reaction.
That's what I wanted to get to.
Is
what's going on?
And in her interview, she said she approached De Palma and she said she really liked De Palma because most directors give you lip service and then tell you to do it their way. And throughout the filming, Piper Laurie said she kept coming to De Palma with these ideas which he thought were really interesting. And in this case, she said, "What if Mrs. White, I mean, how can you put it? It's it's what she's dreamed of. She's becoming a religious martyr. She's in ecstasy. Yeah. She's not screaming in pain.
No, it's orgasmic.
Yes. And that is so cool.
Yeah.
And it's such a better choice. It reminded me of the other thing from the bonus features where Carrie's wedding dress. Freudian slip. Carrie's, I want to marry Carrie. Even scary Carrie.
Cassie.
That's another thing I learned in the bonus features, though. The little kid on the bicycle is Brian De Palma's
nephew. Dubbed.
By Betty Buckley. That was an amazing little tidbit. That originally Carrie's prom dress was supposed to be red.
Yeah.
And in the script, Mrs. White comes in and says, red. It would have to be red.
Yeah.
But the costume designer decided that Sissy Spacek would look much prettier in pink, and she made the dress pink. And I believe De Palma was like, well, we have to change the line. And Piper Laurie said, no, you shouldn't change the line at all. So not only is that terrific,
yeah,
because anything that's a prom dress, Mrs. White would say that.
Right.
But, and I'm not suggesting that Mrs. White is psychic, considering what happens at the prom, that becomes one of the most interesting lines in the film. Red. It would have to be red.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, if the screenwriter had written that, it would have been like, yes, I can take the rest of the day off. I mean, that is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of like the some of the cinematic flourishes? So this is De Palma's real kind of commercial breakthrough.
Yeah,
he had made several movies before this. This is the first adaptation of a Stephen King novel put to screen, and that doesn't really start happening then regularly until The Shining kind of kicks off this wave in the 80s of just there were four Stephen King adaptations a year.
Yeah.
But some of his kind of stylistic flourishes, do you find them effective or distracting?
As you pointed out, the sped up thing in the Tux place just comes
it's
across
a weird choice.
As odd.
Yes.
If only because it's so short. It's really odd and short. It's short.
It is short.
So that if he had done it longer or had it go in and out of that.
There's just no reason for it.
Well, I wonder at the time if people would have thought there was something wrong with the projector.
Yeah.
The thing I love, I've always loved, I kept waiting to see if it would have the same effect on me at home as it did in the theater. The 360-degree pan around them dancing.
Oh, my gosh.
I still remember in the movie theater making me nauseous. And if that's the intent, it does start spinning pretty fast.
Yes.
Then,
but that's because they were spinning also.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That this is this wonderful moment for Carrie, and it's very, very romantic. But talk about using the camera emotionally. Well, there's a downside to this too, kids.
Yeah.
Maybe it can get away. I mean, however you want to express the
metaphor. Right.
I think that comes across great. I think the slow motion at the beginning for horny little boys makes them think, oh, the nudity's on the screen longer, but the slow motion extends to Carrie's shower, which he would sort of later repeat in Dress to Kill. And it's this idol where it gets broken, and it gets broken in such a traumatic, violent way that going from slow motion to regular motion emphasizes that the dream is being broken. I mean, besides the music and everything else.
Yeah, again, it's the high school fantasy interrupted, which is, I think, the whole movie.
And once she starts having her period, it's so traumatic, and the way it's being presented is so traumatic. Yeah. And also the other girl's reaction, and which sometimes I remember, in the book, do the prom goers and some of the teachers actually laugh when the bucket drops?
I believe so.
Okay. Because in the movie, it's Norma. Everyone looks at Norma like, what are you laughing at? And it's very disturbing because clearly it's presented as Carrie believing that that's Carrie's right. take on it, that everyone is not laughing.
Right, right.
So in terms of cinematic things, the crazy camera work around the dancers works. I think the slow motion at the beginning works. That sped up thing and the tux yeah. thing is odd. Are there other sort of show-offy, look at me, I'm a filmmaker things that you either like or don't like in the film?
No, I mean, the split screen, supposedly he had more of it in the movie and then decided to get rid of all of it except for when that finally...
That the prom wouldn't be the only...
Right.
You can kind of see where that might right. have played a part.
And he had done it in Phantom of the Paradise.
Really
to
well.
To amazing I mean, effect. Right, because it's the bomb sequence. In the car. It's maybe less useful here, but I think it's still so effective at changing the mood of the scene.
Yes. Because it happens right when...
Right. And the stuff I really love, and again, part of what I love about Brian De Palma as a filmmaker and every time I watch his movies, is there are few directors outside of Hitchcock who seem to enjoy manipulating the audience more than Brian De Palma. So the slow motion at the beginning is effective. I think the slow motion leading up to the pig's blood is amazing
yeah.
because he draws it out for an insane amount of time. And that's just him fucking with us.
And going back to my previous point about crappy VHS transfers, the lighting in this film, specifically in the prom scene, yeah. is really amazing. Because we're at this high school prom with crazy lights set up in a gym, gives him the excuse that he can play some real giallo lighting mm-hmm, games mm-hmm. and still have it come across as realistic because, oh, these high school kids, oh, this wall is blue and this wall is red. But now that you have a transfer that does the film justice, you're looking at all the lighting in the prom sequence and you're like, this is amazing. And there's a specific moment that I thought was Hitchcockian. De Palma cuts to the bucket of blood and there's a streamer that there's a streamer that yeah. gets loose yeah. and we follow the streamer down and there's that the streamer's one color and the wall is another color. And you're like, this is really good. I mean, just in terms of what you want the audience.
Right, right.
And it's straight Hitchcock. You have two men talking about baseball, and there's a bomb under the table.
Right.
And everyone's applauding the king and queen of the prom, and there's a bucket of pig's blood about to fall.
I believe, and again, some of this is just what you read on IMDb trivia or by reading stuff on the internet. Most of what I read suggested that Amy Irving was originally going to play Carrie and that Sissy Spacek was kind of a last minute switch. Her husband, Jack Fisk, who had worked with De Palma and she had worked on Phantom of the Paradise as a set dresser, sort of got her to audition. De Palma, the story goes, she said, I have this commercial that I could do or I could come audition. And De Palma's like, do the commercial. So she's like, oh, fuck. So she shows up the next day to audition and just nails it and gets the part. But what I was going to mention is obviously not news to anyone, but if it is, that's why I want to bring it up. That famously, the auditions for this film were held in conjunction with the auditions for Star Wars, that Lucas and De Palma sat in the room together and actors came in and sort of read for both. Amy Irving read for Princess Leia. William Catt read for
William
Luke Skywalker.
Catt has a funny story where he read Luke Skywalker and Kurt Russell read Han Solo.
Right.
And William Catt to this day was like, we were pretty good.
And he would have been a good Han Solo.
Yeah.
I could see it.
Oh, yeah.
Or not Han Solo, son of a bitch.
No,
Luke
Kurt
Skywalker.
Russell would have been a
oh,
good...
Oh, forget it. Kurt Russell yeah. could do anything. But William Catt would have been a good Luke Skywalker.
Sure.
I mean, Mark Hamill's great, but man, I love William Catt in this movie so much.
There's another version of that story, though, because on some of the bonus features, especially... now I'm getting all confused, but one of the interviews is with the casting director, and some of the people sort of talk around who... De Palma actually wanted for the role because it's considered polite.
Yeah, right, right.
You didn't get the part. We don't talk about it.
Right.
But then there's other sources that do talk about who De Palma originally wanted, and it wasn't Amy Irving. It was someone else.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The bottom line, though, is that apparently Sissy Spacek put Vaseline in her hair,
right,
and didn't wash her face and wore this sailor suit that her mother had made her,
yeah,
and just went in and killed it.
Yeah.
Which is such a, you know, you like it when the person who deserves it gets it.
So let me ask you this question, because I'm hosting this screening, and obviously, yes, when we're talking about it, I haven't done it yet. So I'm telling some friends about it, and their response is like, I don't know if I could go. I'm too freaked out. It's too scary. Now, when I got that response for A Nightmare on Elm Street, I thought, okay, I get that. People are freaked out by Freddy Krueger, you know. If people are freaked out by horror movies, I see why A Nightmare on Elm Street would upset them. I don't find anything in Carrie scary, unless you're going to talk about Margaret White's fundamentalism or, you know, the abuse. But in terms of like normal horror movie stuff, I don't think there's anything scary in it.
Could it be? And this is what I certainly thought it was with me, because I didn't see it for a really long time. That there's stuff in the movie about going to high school and either being bullied or bullying someone that makes people really uncomfortable. So maybe they're thinking, and here I'm not a psychoanalyst, that if they say it's too scary, clearly they're talking about the last 15 minutes, because as you mentioned, it's not particularly scary until the prom. But maybe what's really going on is that there's other things in the film, and there's plenty of them, as we've discussed, that would make you uncomfortable, and they just rather not.
Maybe. Do the people who were bullies in high school, do they recognize that when they watch this movie? Do they see themselves as Nancy Allen? I feel like everyone, in the same way that when Sex and the City was on and every girl who watched the show would cast it among her friend group, they were always the Sarah Jessica Parker, right?
Yeah. I'm the Mary, you're the Rhoda.
Right. So I think everybody, even who was a bully, might see themselves as Sue Snell, but nobody else. Where it was like, okay, yeah, I was guilty of kind of standing there and laughing too, but I was a good person. I wasn't Nancy Allen.
Well, see, do we have a minute for this?
Yeah.
I come to this film from a very specific place, because in high school, especially in freshman year, I was bullied tremendously. I mean, really, it was really, really bad. I mean, I just had the snot beaten out of me a lot. And then I learned how to get it to stop. And I'm not proud about this, because when I talk about it, it sounds like I'm bragging, but I'm not bragging. I'm glad I found a way to get that to stop. I got really good at saying things that would make people feel so awful in so many different ways that they left me alone.
Okay.
And my wife has maintained that that was not good. That was not a real good thing for me to learn, because sometimes just accidentally I will push someone's button and, oh my God, I didn't mean to do that. So I've tried to watch it, and I've tried to be a better person. But does that mean, if I'm being completely honest, that I was bullied, horribly bullied freshman year, and my response to that was to become the bully? Although I didn't seek people out to taunt.
Right.
I would like to think that defense. I used it defensively, right. But
it was your telekinesis.
I got real good at, yeah. I mean, I'm not proud. And I think that's why I avoided the film for so long.
Okay.
I think your point is fascinating, though. If you were a real grade A prick in high school, do you recognize that?
I don't know that people do. I'm sure there are some people, you know, who really made a conscious choice to change and be a better person like you're talking about. But I also think there are a lot of people who are just kind of, you know, memory, we remember things the way we want to remember them.
Bet.
Cutting themselves slack. Well, I was in high school. I mean, think about how much we've talked about that in the last few weeks, right? I was a kid. I was in high school. It's just what we did.
And my high school experience couldn't have been that bad, because I chose to go back to high school
right, that's
for
true.
33
yeah,
years,
that is
which
true.
Is whatever.
That is true.
Watching it yesterday, it's so great.
It really
is. It's just so well done.
It really is. And it's one of these movies, like you said, that I feel like everybody likes. If you bring it up, you're not going to find too many people who are going to say anything bad about Carrie, like you said, except like, oh, it's dated. But that nobody really talks about as being a classic.
And I think, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, I think there are aspects to the film that make people so uncomfortable that, in a way, it's a victim of its own success. It's too successful at making you uncomfortable about the high school experience, about the way Mrs. White behaves, the way at the end there's no morality on display. Don't be around when this power is unleashed.
We should also mention before we jump off that we have this movie to thank and blame for the one last scare phenomenon.
Oh, yes.
That became...
Which the makers of Friday the 13th have said, gleefully
yes.
admitted,
yes.
that they copied.
That they admit to stealing. Other stuff, not as much. Bava, never heard of him.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was that right before I came here today, my wife, my lovely wife, only half in jest said, okay, here's a film about a young woman who's being bullied in high school, and it's about her sexual burgeoning and how she gradually gains power. That sounds like the right topic for two men to talk about. So I'm sorry if we offended any of you. I think we could still have something to say about the film.
Hopefully.
But I'm not a woman.
No.
I prayed for ovaries. They never came.
Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. Please keep the 7-word reviews coming and keep coming to fthismovie.com all month long because we got lots of cool stuff coming. Thanks, J-Bones.
They're all going to laugh at you.
You had to do it.
Had to.